OK, we're really more interested in the Sino-US relationship. What about Sung Hae, Neil Bush? What do you think are his good qualities? I want to understand the attitude of how Americans do business.
Once we're friends, I'll have a lot to tell you, and we shall be friends if you don't write about the last 3 points, that is, the rumors about his past.
That's Gordon Tang speaking to Intercept reporter Elaine Yu, and he called her from the airport in Hong Kong to say he had an envelope for her, a red envelope.
That's right. He had a lacy, which is a traditional Chinese envelope for giving gifts, but he offered what is essentially a bribe not to report certain aspects of the story, offering $200,000 in unspecified currency.
What was he so concerned about?
He was concerned about allegations about a company he controlled that was investigated for smuggling and tax evasion in Shantou.
And was he implicated?
Members of his family and his business were implicated.
Well, we're going to do part two of this conversation. It's a lengthy expose, and we want to really dig into it. And you can watch it at democracynow.org. Li Fang, investigative journalist at The Intercept, covering the intersection of money and politics. This series is called Foreign Influence, and that does it for our show. We have two job openings. We have a development manager and a senior video producer. Go to democracynow.org for the information. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Paul Huckabee are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio with host Joanne Hardesty. Today's guests are Liz Moore, director of the Spokane Peace and Justice Action Works, and Reverend Harriet Walden of Moms for Police Accountability. We'll talk about their upcoming conference, Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability Summer Gathering, which will be held at Portland State University.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Abrupt Climate Change. A talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost in Portland. Dr. Guy McPherson is a professor of conservation biology and an author. He'll present his synthesis of the current peer-reviewed research on Earth's recent phase of rapid warming. Again, that's Abrupt Climate Change, a talk with Dr. Guy McPherson, Monday, August 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Waypost, 3120 North Williams Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, A Letter from Momo, will play Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. A Letter to Momo has been described as a Japanese anime Alice in Wonderland. As is so often the case in Japanese animation, displacement and emotional upheaval lead to interaction with the supernatural. Again, that's A Letter from Momo, Thursday, August 11th, at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th, 2016 at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds in Salem. For the first time ever, Oregon's producers will be able to display live plants at the Cannabis Fair. Over 60 grows will be showcased this year, and there will be awards for the winning plants in several categories. Again, that's the Oregon Cannabis Growers Fair starting Saturday, August 13th at 10 a.m. and ending Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at the Oregon State Fairgrounds, 2330 17th Street, Northeast in Salem. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Thank you. It is my pleasure to have with me today Liz Moore. She's the director of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, and Reverend Harriet Walden, who is the founder of Mothers for Police Accountability Seattle. Welcome you both to the program this morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. It's great to have you both here. Okay, it looks like we lost Reverend Harriet Walden, but she will be joining us shortly. So Liz, in this opportunity that we have, it would be great to say a little bit about what the Peace Justice Action League of Spokane, what is your role, what's your mission?
Mm-hmm. Well, our mission is to build a just and nonviolent world. And this year we're celebrating 40 years in Spokane. We're an independent membership-based organization, and our agenda is set by our members here. Our work is community organizing and grassroots leadership, and we focus on peace, economic justice, and human rights, knowing that all of those pieces of our vision are preconditions for each other, and that human rights does not exist without economic justice, which cannot exist without peace. So right now we are focusing on police accountability and criminal justice reform, reducing or addressing mass incarceration in our own community and racial disparities in our own community with regard to policing and criminal justice. We're working to oppose an anti-immigrant profiling initiative, which will appear on the November 2017 ballot in Spokane, and we are continuing our 40-year work of organizing against militarism and war with a focus on truth in recruitment and getting information to high school students who are considering enlistment. We also have a big concentration on leadership development, knowing that it is grassroots leaders who are most critical in building an intergenerational peace and justice movement that really has the power and the wherewithal to take on these systems and win, at least sometimes. And so we have a 9-month leadership development program called the Young Activist Leaders Program that prepares young people, assists young people, supports young people in their work as social justice leaders of today, not waiting for some kind of mythical tomorrow where the rest of us magically step aside, but actually supporting youth as leaders right now.
Wonderful.
And we do a number of leadership development events throughout the year to support grassroots people as leaders.
Excellent. And Reverend Harriet Walden has rejoined us. Good morning, Harriet. Welcome to the program.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. And good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
And so Liz was just giving us an overview of the work of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane. And Harriet, if you would be kind enough to give us an overview of what the mission and the work of Mothers for Police Accountability does in Seattle.
Oh, well, thank you. This September will be our 26th year, and we started out as Mothers Against Police Harassment because that's what we saw a lot of. And as we moved on, we changed our name for Mothers for Police Accountability. Our goal is to educate the public, you know, what to do when you get stopped by the police. We go to court with people. We work on policy changes and training. And right now, I'm one of the co-chairs of the Community Police Commission that was established up under the settlement agreement of the DOJ. Recently, we've been involved with Courageous Conversation Community Dialogue after all the events happened last month. We've been leading conversation and dialogue around where do we go from here. And on the 15th of this month, we will have leave another one for youth to come in and just to talk about just what they are experiencing because there's a lot of things going on. And so we work well with Coalition. We work with the ACLU, the Church Council of Greater Seattle, and many other groups as it works to have an impact on this unjust system. But our main goal right now is to work with young people and to help them to, what to do when they do get stopped by the police. We worked on a national level before, been part of many tribunals across the country. And we just kind of keep at it. It's ebb and flow. Sometimes you have a lot of work and a lot of people, and sometimes you don't. It's according to what's going on. But right now, a lot of things is just going on, not even in our community, that's around the country that's been leading our work because, with all the high-profile shootings and no convictions, that's really what's at the heart of our work. And also working on police reform here in Seattle. I mean, it's really critical that we get it right this time, and having some difficulty here working on that with all the parties at the table.
Well, we're going to get into that a little bit, Harriet. Thank you so much for the overview.
Sure.
And I want to let my listening audience know that we are preparing for a conference next week in starting Friday at 5 p.m. at Portland State University and Smith Center on the third floor ballroom. And this is a gathering of the Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability organizations, which the three of us make up the organization. We are planning to have people from Spokane, Seattle, and Portland come together and share their best learnings, because all three of our communities have had Department of Justice intervention. Each of us have had different intervention from the Department of Justice, but all of us have been involved at the grassroots level trying to reform policing in our community. And so I'm so excited that we're going to all be in the same space next week, and that this conference is coming together and will be the first opportunity to bring these three communities together to share and learn from each other. Liz, would you like to talk a little bit about how this Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability came about?
Yeah. I would. I was thinking it's been, I think, 2.5 years now that
yes.
we've been seeking to understand each other's work and learn from each other. And it started out and has mostly been conference calls where we can share what's happening on the ground in each of our cities, what's happening with the Department of Justice process in each of our cities, what's working in terms of community formulation of vision and demands, how are the institutions pushing back, and how are community-based organizations pushing right back on institutions as the sort of cycle goes forward. And it's been really fascinating for me to see that what's true in Spokane is also true in Seattle and Portland, which is that it is, as you said, Joanne, there's no substitute for an organized community.
Yes.
And that it really comes down to any permanent change has to be made in a way that increases the power of grassroots communities and organizations and people so that that change is actually going to address the realities of people's experiences and can actually be maintained, because we know that any victory only is a victory in the moment that we win it, and then right away it becomes a thing we have to work to maintain. So it's been really fascinating and quite a delight for me to get to work with the two of you over the last couple of years, and really wonderful to have been able to host you both in Spokane for our action conference in February. And we know that we hope that a lot of folks from all three cities and anywhere else in the Northwest will join us in Portland next weekend so that we can learn from each other and build relationships face to face.
Absolutely. And there is a Facebook page to register for the conference. We certainly will be doing on-site registration, but it's always better for folks to sign up in advance so we get a sense for how many people will be there and how much food we need to buy. And so, Harriet, what are you looking most forward to in this convening?
Well, I'm looking forward to actually beginning to build a network of in the region between Portland, Oregon, and Washington State, and eventually maybe Idaho, and almost Region 10. Except, we're building a foundation of to begin working on sustainability and how do we empower these communities, not only our communities but other communities. Because we know that in the larger cities, I mean, you know, the metro areas, you know, we're working on these issues, and we have a network. But out in the smaller areas, you know, out in the rural areas, in the smaller areas in Washington State, and I'm sure in the rural and the smaller areas in Oregon, police accountability is a whole different animal, and sometimes the people don't even have anyone to call on.
Right.
So my hopes for this conference is begin to build a foundation so we can have some sustainability, some strong networks, and to be able to train communities what good policy looks like. I mean, what good procedures are. A lot of times, you know, I mean, the police comes up with the guns drawn and all of that. Those are felony stops, and sometimes that's not even good. Sometimes that's bad policing. And
right.
So just be able to get people to understand what's going on and to make new friends. I love making new friends. I want some new friends doing this work.
Well, wonderful. I guess the good news about making new friends is we have a much more aware populace now that we have a problem, a fundamental problem with policing in the United States of America. And so I think that's the good news. The good news is we've almost like the 60s, we have this reawakening of people that really understand there's a fundamental problem. And so it's my hope that celebrate and appreciate the fabulous young people who will be participating on Friday evening in the open mic and talk back that will take place Friday evening at PSU starting at 7:30 p.m. And I've actually connected with a couple of young people who are really excited about being able to participate. I'm also excited because a project that I've been working on this summer, Youth in the Law Project, I have some young people who have developed a tool on knowing your rights for incoming freshmen into Portland Public Schools next year. So they will be sharing their tool and their training curriculum at our conference next weekend. And so I'm really excited about that because these young people are between 16 and 22. And they realized that they needed to develop a tool so that other young people would be safe in their encounters with the police. And so everything you guys said, and in addition to what I've just added, are all the things that excite me about this conference. I also think that it's an opportunity, I think as Harriet said, to start building this Pacific Northwest team that's very intentional about our work around holding police accountable. And so if you're just joining the conversation, I am speaking with Liz Moore, who's the director of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane, and Reverend Harriet Walden, who is the founder of Mothers for Police Accountability of Seattle. And if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And we're discussing the Northwest Community Coalition convening that will take place next week, August 12th and 13th, at Portland State University. Liz, tell me about what you tell me about the folks that will be coming from Spokane to participate. What do you think? Are these grassroots folks that you've worked with, part of your coalition? Who are the people that you think would be most interested in participating in this conference?
Yeah, folks who are coming from Spokane include a marvelous investigative journalist, Tim Connor, who has been covering police issues in Spokane since the early 80s and has a sort of institutional memory that is unrivaled in our community, really understands the history and track record over time. And he will be part of a panel about nitty-gritty kind of approaches on the ground, legal approaches on the ground, because here in Spokane we have amended our city charter through a yes, through a 70% yes vote by the people in February 2013 to mandate independent investigations by the Office of Police Ombudsman. Yet, although we had thought we had won, actually, that that city charter amendment has yet to be correctly and fully implemented. And this is the year that our city will be in negotiations with the police guild, whose contract currently prohibits independent investigations. And so this is a big year for us to work with city council to win some changes and win the correct and full implementation of that amendment and actually get independent investigations. So he'll be there. Tim Connor is his name. We're also going to be joined by one of the members of the Office of Police Ombudsman Commission, which is our community commission that oversees the Office of Police Ombudsman. And this Reverend Deb Conklin, who is coming, is the chair of that commission and has been working on police accountability for quite a number of years here, and brings a very interesting set of skills as both a former deputy prosecutor and a Methodist minister and community organizer. So I'm looking forward to what she brings to the conversation. And then other folks who are coming are regular community folks, low-income and middle-income folks who are committed to not just reforming the police, but really in the very long term transforming these systems of violence and domination that typify our entire society and every institution and system within it, and really looking at how do we win, how do we advance now in ways that advance this longer-term transformation. So it's a really exciting and really smart bunch of folks.
It sounds like it's going to be a very, very a very good opportunity for people to get lots of information about what's happening on the ground in Spokane, Portland, and Seattle. So, Harriet, what give us a sense of the folks that are coming from Seattle and some of the folks that will potentially be on the panels as well as participating.
Well, I reached out to the No New Jails campaign. I mean, you got a lot of young people here. The bond passed a few years ago to build a new juvenile facility, and people have been working hard to keep that from happening, the new the No New Jail campaign. Also, some people from the commission are coming. I'm one of the co-chairs. Lisa Dugard is coming, and she'll be bringing her daughter. And the author of the body camera article, there's an extensive article about body cameras and, you know, just all the pros and cons about it. Lynn Wilson, and she wrote that article, and it's been circulated around the country now. And she's coming. And I reached out to a lot of other young people, and they, you know, they're telling me that they're coming, and I'm working with them. I reached out to the Not This Time movement. They met last night, and they meet every Wednesday night as a result of the one. We've had one shooting in Seattle this year, an African-American man that got shot. And this one African-American person has been shot, but I think it's been more than one shooting. And they are the people who've been working on this initiative to get the law changed to make it easier to charge a police officer with a crime by removing the words malice and good faith. So I reached out to them, and they are coming. So
wonderful.
We're excited about people coming from Seattle.
Wonderful. It certainly sounds like this is going to be a really good opportunity. I think one of the things us activists rarely do is take moments to celebrate and appreciate the work that we've done. And because I've spent almost 3 years on the phone with you two ladies, I know that you absolutely are in that category, because at the end of the day, the reality is that we've accomplished a lot in the time that we've been working on police accountability. And so I certainly hope that we can celebrate some of our success, even though we know success is never permanently won, whether it's at the ballot box or whether it's by public policy or whether it's by advocacy. It's not permanently won. It's just temporarily won. And we know we have to keep our eyes on the prize in order to make sure that it stays won. And so for my listeners, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 503-231-8187. And so the conference, I love the fact that we're going to start with an action. And the action will be participating in the Keaton Otis Vigil that happens the 12th of every month. And so we have a plan to get on Max, go over to Six and Halsey, participate in the vigil, and then come back to Portland State and eat and have music and spoken word and celebrate the fact that we are together and that we are continuing to push the envelope to ensure that each of our communities have the kind of policing that we want and deserve. So Liz, you were talking about, I love the fact that when I first started talking to you, you talked about this ballot initiative that was passed. And so when we first started talking, we were absolutely convinced it was passed by the ballot. So, of course, the Spokane City Council will implement it as the voters intended.
Yes.
We have realized that that was not the case. Can you talk a little bit about how the powers that be political leaders chose to implement it versus what the voters thought they were voting to implement?
Mm-hmm. Well, voters believed that they were voting for and what was written on the ballot, which was independent investigations by an independent body, so that when a member of our community has a concern about the police, or when there's a shooting or an incident, that people can complain directly, can bring their concerns to the Office of Police Ombudsman and have an independent investigation. What has been happening instead of that is that the Office of Police Ombudsman largely serves as intake for internal affairs. And when people bring a complaint to the Office of Police Ombudsman, what happens is that an investigation process can then be triggered by internal affairs, and the ombudsman basically audits that process and can certify or decline to certify whether that process was done in a way that was timely, objective, and thorough. What we want is for the police not to be the only body to investigate the police. We want independent investigations. And we want closing reports from the ombudsman that go further than addressing the process and that make substantive recommendations about policy changes, training changes, changes in practice, that isn't a separate piece from the question of whether a particular officer should be disciplined or not. What we want is we want to open the curtains on the police department and get more information out to the community about the experience of community members with our police department, and use that information then as stepping stones to press for specific policy changes, because we'll actually be able to see into our to our department. So when we passed that city charter amendment in 2013, the mayor's administration, Mayor Condon, was in the midst of negotiating with the police guild. And our Office of Police Ombudsman had been created in a way that entangled it in the disciplinary process. Washington, with good, strong labor laws, is very clear about what has to be bargained and what doesn't. And it was created in a way that that entangled it with the disciplinary process, such that everything then had to be bargained. It couldn't just be decided by the city administration. Wow. It had to be bargained with the police guild. And so the first thing that happened in 2013 is that Mayor Condon refused to direct the city attorney to bargain to implement this city charter amendment. And all they did was keep the pre-existing clause, but add a sentence to say that it didn't conflict with the city charter, which, of course, doesn't make it true. You can write any sentence you want to write. It doesn't make it a true sentence.
Absolutely.
That was their first try. And we moved the city council to reject that contract and to send Mayor Condon back to the bargaining table with the guild. But then they came back with a very slightly improved model that allows for independent investigations only in cases where a five-step process occurs prior, and does not allow the Office of Police Ombudsman to just take an investigation, take a complaint from the public. It does not make clear that the ombudsman has the right to just take a complaint from a community member and just launch an investigation, and actually limits what the Office of Police Ombudsman can do in terms of reporting to the public. So that's what we've been living with. And in the meantime, we have had quite a series of fiascos within our city government, including being without an ombudsman for a year and a half, so that even the process that we have has never been fully implemented because it hasn't been staffed since January 2015. We now have an interim ombudsman, and soon we'll have an ombudsman who is permanent, I believe, but it will be almost 2 years that we will not have had a permanent ombudsman, and for a year and a half, no ombudsman at all in that position. So,
Liz, we haven't even gotten to the issues with your police chiefs. but I am going to pause us and go to the phone line.
Great.
We have Frances on the line. Good morning, Frances. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Joanne.
Good morning.
I'm happy you guys are doing this. Now, is this just on Friday or is it going all weekend?
No, it's Friday and Saturday. So Friday evening is the welcome reception and speak out. And all day Saturday will be workshops and speakers starting at 9 a.m. Going through 4 p.m.
Sweet. Is there a fee or anything?
There is a fee. Living Lightly fee is $10. And the general registration fee is $30.
Okay.
But no one will be turned away for lack of funds.
Okay. I do know Keaton was a friend of my son's, so yes. I'll be at the vigil. So is it okay if someone just joins you there?
Absolutely.
And comes back to the conference?
That would be fabulous, yes, because that's when we'll officially kick it off when we get back from the vigil.
Okay, cool. And I have a question about all these agreements that the Department of Justice has with various municipalities all over the country. As it seems, they're not really being very effective. And I'm wondering, I noticed that in the one that was written for Portland, and it's probably common in all of them, there's a clause at the beginning that says the city, by entering this agreement, admits no guilt or responsibility for the things that have happened. And I was wondering, if they don't honor the agreement, what is the consequence? Does anybody know what will happen if the city is found to be in violation of the agreement?
Well,
will there be some kind of consequences for the city itself from the Department of Justice?
Good question, Frances. So I can tell you what what happened in Portland, and maybe Liz and Harriet can weigh in about what would happen in their city. So in Portland, because it is a settlement agreement, if they are out of compliance with the settlement agreement, the federal judge could declare that they're out of compliance, and that would put it back on the Department of Justice, because then the Department of Justice would have to decide whether or not to file federal lawsuit against Portland Police Bureau and the city of Portland. The chances of that happening, I believe, in Portland are slim to none. But what about Liz and Harriet?
I just wanted to say one other thing, and then I'll get off the air and they can answer also. But I noticed that we spend a lot of time on oversight after the fact,
right?
After they've already killed our babies. And I would like to know if there's any discussion about screening officers before they even get on the force, as far as, you know, whether or not they may be susceptible to their little biases.
So I'm curious
if there's any work on that at all.
Well, I will share what we're doing in Portland, but I'm very curious as to what Liz and Harriet know about that process in their respective communities. So when you hang up, I'll give everybody an opportunity to respond. Thanks for the call, Francis. See you on the 12th.
All righty. Bye-bye.
The number to call, 503-231-8187. And so, Harriet, let me start with you. I think the first question was around, is there any screening being done at the front end rather than at the back end around policing and who gets to become a police officer?
Yeah, there is screening that's going on here before police can become an officer. And also, you know, I don't know if you've heard of the new idea between a warrior and the new idea around policing, training police to be a warrior or a guardian. And that's coming out of the 21st century policing, you know, from the White House. But also it's being implemented here in the training in Washington State with Sue Raw. And she was at a community meeting about 6 weeks ago. And she talked about the new training that's going on. And I mean, it sounds hopeful that in the future we will get better police officers coming out the academy. And, of course, the training here in King County, they train for the whole state. Mm-hmm. And so, that's encouraging. But one of the things she asked about also, what happens if the community – if the community or the city is not in compliance.
Right.
Well, I know what was in the news with Ferguson is that the government came back in to sue Ferguson because they decided that they wasn't going to follow any of the rules. And so Ferguson might be another place to look at to see what the Justice Department is doing.
Very true. I was just going to say, you're right, because in Ferguson, they actually did not agree with the Department of Justice finding. So there was no settlement agreement, right? They just said, no, we're not going to, what you found, we don't believe, and we're not going to do it. So that's why they're being sued.
Right.
So you can finish.
Right.
Go ahead.
Right. All right. And here in Seattle, we do have a settlement agreement, we've had difficult times with the Community Police Commission being, we're not a party, so we have amicus status, means that we can file after the fact, after something else has been filed by the other two parties, so we're not a recognized party. Mm-hmm. And so we have a monitor here who does not believe that we have any kind of capability. And so as it stands right now, we've been working on these issues for 2 years. I mean, since 2013, we've done a lot of work around policy training, policy and procedures, and bias and terrorist stops, and so what looks like here is that our work is going to be in vain after the 15th of August when we go to court, unless we get some help from the Justice Department. So what we see is that sometimes the Justice Department don't always stand up for you. Even after they come in and want to constitute and, you know, come up with the Community Police Commission, because we're the first one that they wanted to set up. And so far, we have not had the backing from them. So So it's going to be really interesting. And we're going to have a good time on Saturday talking about these issues and
yes.
how absolutely every city is different and what the DOJ brings to town.
Thank you for that, Harriet. We're going to go back to the phone line. We can continue to answer that question after this next call. Good morning, Caroline. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi.
Hi, still there? I think we may have lost her. Please call back, Caroline. I'll give Liz an opportunity to answer that question. Liz, the question about are we trying to influence people before they become police officers? And if so, how? The question.
Yeah, it's a really great question. And to be honest, that's not a piece that I have looked at closely enough to know what the realities are currently of mm-hmm. how officers are screened. It's something I've been talking about with a number of people. I think we need to recognize that one of the realities is that because police department is a civil service job, there is a hiring preference for people who have given military service. And just knowing the realities of the percentage of folks that come back with diagnosed or undiagnosed mental damage, spiritual and psychological damage, and PTSD from time in the military,
right.
That I think we need to be honest about the fact that that's going to create an applicant pool with a higher likelihood of not having, not being ready emotionally, mentally, psychologically to deal with moments of crisis in ways that are mindful. And I think we have to be really honest about that reality. It particularly calls for very, very substantive screening and analysis of someone's readiness to deal with moments of crisis, you know, for 8 to 12 hours a day for an entire week, and then correctly do it again the next week.
Right.
So I don't know the current realities. I can say that in Spokane, we do not have a consent decree with the police, with the Department of Justice. What we have is a technical assistance and set of recommendations from the Department of Justice, which our police department voluntarily made a commitment to implement, but because it is a set of recommendations, it doesn't come with any consequences at all, except the loss of support from the Department of Justice in that technical assistance role. But here in Spokane, it's only voluntary. The Department of Justice did not come in and do a full patterns and practices investigation.
Right.
They just did an audit and gave a set of recommendations.
Thank you for that, Liz. I can tell you that in Portland, back in 2013, the AMA Coalition for Justice and Police Reform, which I'm a part of, challenged our city council because we have a psychologist named David Corey who, up until that point, always got a contract renewal from the city of Portland to determine the psychological fitness of people to become police officers. The more we investigated, we found out that this David Corey has most of the contracts for the policing agencies throughout the Portland metropolitan area. So the three largest counties, Clackamas, Washington, and Multnomah County, he has locked up all these contracts over a long period of time. And prior to 2013, his contract was extended 9 times without ever an RFP to see if there was another psychologist that could actually do the same job. And as governments are prone to do, it becomes a self-defeating process, right? There's no one else qualified because we've never given anyone else the opportunity to be qualified because we keep giving all the contracts to David Corey, right? And so we challenged the city councils. Once again, they were about to renew his contract for another 4 years. And we were like, in a state with over 13,000 certified psychologists, you mean there's only one that's actually qualified to determine whether someone can be a police officer? And so they actually did. We forced them to do a request for proposal. They sent it out. Guess what? David Coy got the contract again, but there was a smaller contract given to another psychologist to be mentored by him so that when the contract comes up for renewal, maybe somebody else could actually get the contract. But this is a great example of if the community is not paying attention, if the community is not monitoring how police become police, we end up in these kind of situations. And so it, to me, it was absolutely ludicrous that we would have this one guy who was the only person in the Portland metro area with that responsibility. That contract, that was 2013. And so I would think that contract is probably coming up again in 2017. And so we will be keeping an eye on that, on the request for proposal when it comes back, and make sure that it's not just extended again like they're so prone to do, like they did nine times before without the public having input in it. And so that's Portland. I'm going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Caroline. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
It's a really interesting topic. I mean, because I heard, like, for example, the PTSD, and police go through a lot of stress, and a lot of times a lot of cops might go and they encounter a black citizen and they are afraid. I would like to suggest, I mean, aside from the cultural training to eliminate biases, to maybe, I mean, immediately have all of the police officers wear a wristwatch that's capable of monitoring heart rate and maybe endocrine levels. For example, if a police officer goes to an encounter and then all of a sudden his heart beat, his adrenaline is pumping. I mean, when you have adrenaline pumping, you're not able to make good decisions. It's fight or flight. So that's when they take out their gun and they shoot without thinking about it. So, I mean, if a watch can monitor a police officer's heart rate and endocrine levels to determine if there's adrenaline, they could flash a light or give him some kind of warning. And so at least his partner can see that as well, and that police officer needs to back off for a little bit and call for backup or have his partner take over. So there needs to be some kind of accountability, because they're humans as well, that we need to realize even though they're in these stressful situations, they need to realize when their body is overreacting, when their judgment is impaired, and when it's time to really back off and let a more neutral party come in and litigate a difficult situation. So, I mean, the technology is available. We have the smartwatches and all those things. So, I mean, that could be an immediate solution or an immediate something we could do right away.
Right.
While we're working on the deeper systemic issues of inherent bias, training, and all those things. But a police officer needs to be made aware of when his judgment is impaired. You know, when his adrenaline is pumping up, he needs to back off and let someone else take over.
Thank you, Chris. That sounds like a wonderful idea, and sounds like it would be a lot less expensive than the body cam proposal that's under consideration at the moment.
Probably both in conjunction, you know, because if you can see, well, my watch went off, but I didn't see that, you know what I mean?
Right.
So that, I mean, maybe both in conjunction with the watch right away, I think would be at least to give our society and the members of our society a cue that, yes, we're taking this seriously, and yes, officers are people too, and they get stressed and they feel stressed, and apart from their bias, you know, adrenaline and stress impairs your judgment. So, yeah.
Absolutely
okay.
True. Thank you
so much.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Have a good day. 503-231-8187 is the number to call if you'd like to join the conversation. If you've just joined, I'm talking with Liz Moore. She's the director of the Peace and Justice Action League of Spokane. And I'm talking to Reverend Harriet Walden, who is the founder of Mothers for Police Accountability Seattle. And we are discussing our upcoming conference, the Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability Conference, that will take place at Portland Portland State University next weekend, starting Friday at 5 p.m. and all day Saturday, August 13th. There is a cost. There's a Facebook page. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. And it is really an opportunity for grassroots practitioners working on police accountability to come together and share promising practices, share success and failures, and to build the network that will continue to do this work into the future. We're going to go back to the phone line. Good morning, Michael. Welcome to KBOO. Are you there, Michael?
Hello?
Hey, Michael. Welcome.
Hi. You know, first of all, I do have a point I want to make, but I want to address what that lady just said that got off the phone. It seems like in the police department, only the white male is the one that's fearful for his life. You never hear any shootings about the white female cop shooting anybody. Mm-hmm. The black cop, he don't seem to be scared. He ain't shooting nobody. No, the Asian cop, he's not out there shooting anybody. Only the white male in the police department seems to have a problem with fear. Now, the other point I want to make is there a word called impunity.
Right.
Impunity is really the culprit here because that allows the police to just shoot you and continue to shoot you and nothing happens.
Right.
And we see, all we got to do is go back to Hitler and see that impunity caused 6 million people to lose their lives. And so I think that's the worst scenario or the worst situation with the police department around the world is that they can kill, they got carte blanche, they can kill with no consequences. Talk to you later.
Thank you for the call, Michael. There's nothing I can argue with about what you said. I will just challenge you that there have certainly been Asian Pacific Islander police officers who have killed out of fear. I remember the New York story about the housing complex. Officer Peter Lang is Asian Pacific right. Islander, and he certainly shot and killed a man because he was fearful in the walkway of a walk-up apartment complex. You could certainly see with the Eric Gardner picture, the Michael Brown picture, that there were African-American officers involved. And so I think fear cuts across race and gender. I think you're right. I cannot recall a case of a female officer killing someone out of fear. And I'm sure there must be those cases, but I can't recall one of those offhand. Liz or Harriet, you want to comment?
Excuse me. I don't know of any where a female officer has shot anyone either. One of the things that we have here in Seattle is Mothers for Police Accountability and another group. We have an alliance with the African American police women, and what we're working with them is to be able to bring, to take and have a relationship with young girls, because what we realize that black police women shoot less than anyone. If anyone out there is black women, they shoot less than anyone else. Out there, and so we have this alliance been going on for since 2005, nice. Bringing young girls and working with the black police women just to empower them and to see police women in a different light. So that's one of the good things that we're doing, and that's one of the reasons why we reached out to the black police women, because we believe that they police differently, and women sometimes use their intuition a little bit differently. I mean, that men have intuition, but they don't always use it. Yes. But women tend to use their intuition a little bit differently, and they use it sometimes to de-escalate an event.
You're absolutely right, Harriet. I was actually talking to a female police officer just last week who talked about how her best skill is her words, being able to communicate effectively with individuals to the point where she says that the male officers many times call her to help because they know that she can talk to a suspect much more effectively than they are able to. I think you're absolutely right about that. Also, it matters whether the police officers have a connection to the neighborhood they are policing. What I know locally is police officers who were born and raised in Portland Portland and become police officers later rarely pull their gun, rarely have to use force because they know the families of the people that they're encountering on the street. I think I got an opportunity to get one more call in. Good morning, James. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. I think that's a very important point that you just made right there is that, you know, we need police officers who are connected to the communities.
Yes.
There was a great interview yesterday with Norm Stamper who did that book called To Protect and Serve.
Yes.
And that was one of the points that he made is that, you know, and I know this for a fact because my brother-in-law is a police officer. He lives in Gresham, but he works in Tigard.
Right.
They're encouraged to not work in the same places that they live in, but I think that's a huge problem too. Is that it's like how do you effectively create relationships when
yes.
you know when you're not able to be a when you're not an active part of that community?
Absolutely.
And, you know, and more importantly, having he also said you know having events where you know people can talk to police officers, but in a way that it's not set up to be like a PR stunt.
Yes.
You know, like the Wichita Black Lives Matter and the police out there having a barbecue, which, you know,
yes.
I can't really say too much on because, you know, every community is going to be different. Everybody's going to have their way of settling their things. And ultimately what we're looking for is more police accountability.
Yes.
You know, but I mean, the truth of the matter is that that's what we need to be going for is more community inclusion. You know, having people being able to feel free to walk in and out of the police department.
Yes.
Regardless of whether you're white, black, or brown, and being able to feel like you're just as accepted as anybody else.
Exactly so. Thank you so much. Appreciate your call.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
503-231-8187. We are getting minus on minutes, so I want to remind folks that the Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability's convening will take place at Portland State University Smith Center starting on Friday evening at 5 p.m. on August 12th, continuing all day Saturday from 9 a.m. until 4 p.m. We would love to have you there. There is a small fee, but again, no one will be turned away for lack of funds. If you are a police accountability activist in this region of the country, you are welcome. Any last words? I'll start with Liz.
I should have said this earlier, but if folks can't find it on Facebook or if it's easier to find it on the internet, people can find it on our website, peacejustice.org. And you can either type in peacejustice.org/NWCCPA, Northwest Community Coalition for Police Accountability, or you can go to peacejustice.org and just search for the word police, and it'll come right up. And there's a link at the top of that post to get to the registration page. And I really do hope folks will come, because I think it's going to be a really energizing and rejuvenating time. I always feel more sustained for the long term to get through those ebbs and flows, which sometimes seem to happen on a weekly basis.
Yes.
after I connect with other people who are working on the same piece of work, working on the same fabric. So I hope everybody that is interested, that either is a current activist or is a, you know, kind of activist curious, come and check it out.
Excellent. And Harriet, any last words?
I'm really excited, and I will be out today and this weekend recruiting and talking to people about the conference even more so. I mean, we have the Black Community Parade this weekend, so I'll be out passing out flyers. I think this is an opportunity to build a foundation to for sustainability. And I'm really excited about, you know, one journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. And we're taking that journey to build this a coalition for this region. And I'm ecstatic about that.
Thank you so much. Oh, there are some listeners said, thank you for all I do. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Well, this has been wonderful. It's been such a pleasure getting to know you two ladies over the last 3 years. It's been fabulous working with you. I mean, who knew you could actually put a conference together across 3 cities, 2 states, and bring people together for a common cause. I have lots of love and respect for both of you. You do phenomenal work in your community, and thank you so much for working with me to make this conference a reality. It is my hope that we deepen our relationships, that we create opportunities for new activists to get engaged and connected to the issue, and three, that we renew ourselves through this process by knowing, A, we are not alone, and B, that there is a community out there that is working towards justice. And so for all of that, I thank you, Liz Moore. I thank you, Reverend Harriet Walden, and I will see you guys next week. This has been Voices from the Edge. I am Joanne Hardesty, and next week I will be bringing some young people that developed the tool Youth in the Law. Can't wait to talk to you about that. Have a great day. Take care, Steve. Thanks for making us sound great. See you next week, same time, same place, same station. Have a great day.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that glitter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right.
And good morning, KBOO, KBOO Portland, your community radio station on a Thursday morning, a minute now before 9 o'clock. Coming up in a half hour, we've got Fight the Empire. Today, host Per Fogering speaks with John Michael Greer about his book, Dark Age America, Climate Change, Cultural Collapse, and the Hard Future Ahead. We'll have Chris Andre at 10 o'clock with Air Cascadia, Flashpoints at 10:15. At 11, Between the Covers, host Bethany Grabo talks with John Corey Whaley. At 11:30, we'll have Black Book Talk this week with Portland-based author and educator Renee Watson. That's all coming up, but first, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. That's next on KBOO.
Come over here, to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services.